This is a 3-part episode. Come back next Wednesday for part 3.
So this is pretty much a prison just for mental health. And the unfortunate thing is that this is also a co-ed place. So men and women are there. Yeah. So I have to, you know, I take my medications, I sleep, I wake up the next morning. There is another nice gentleman who actually hates women and likes to yell down the hallway of all the things that he likes to do to women and how much he wants to kill the women. And I'm like, oh, this is really nice.
Welcome to the American Grown Podcast, hosted by Austin Sullivan. The American Grown Podcast will focus on people from different walks of life and their journey to where they are now. Now, turn up your volume and settle in for a great episode.
This is the American Grown Podcast, recorded inside the ColorTech Creative Solutions Studios. This episode is brought to you by these sponsors.
Navigating the college journey can be overwhelming, but it doesn't have to be. At College Knowledge Foundation, we're here to guide students and families every step of the way. From choosing the right college to crafting standout essays and understanding financial aid, our virtual sessions and free consultations provide the tools you need to succeed. Join the growing community of students and families who've discovered how to take control of their college journey. Visit College Knowledge Foundation to learn more, book a session, or explore our free resources today.
A&M Pizza, authentic Italian food made with the finest quality ingredients. Proudly serving the Lebanon and Lancaster area since 1980. Stop by their Campbelltown location today. You'll be happy you did. Haynes Auto Detailing, run by owner Josh Haynes, offers a professional service that is sure to have your vehicle shining from wheel to wheel. My wife and I both trust Josh with our personal vehicles, and believe me, with 2 kids, the back seats tend to look like a hot mess. But after a trip to Haynes Auto Detailing, the vehicles look better than brand new, both inside and out. Message Haynes Auto Detailing on Facebook or call 717-679-3673 to get your vehicle looking right today. Are you in the mood for getting out of your house this evening? Head over to Boyer's Tavern in Rexmont, PA. They have appetizers, soups, salads, wings, mouth-watering burgers, sandwiches, and many other entrees to choose from. Proper food and drinks made by slightly improper folks. Head over to Boyer's Tavern today or give them a call at 717-450-4063.
So crisis got involved, and then the next morning I went to work.
Yeah.
And so this gets really weird, just to prepare you.
Okay, I'm buckled in.
Okay, buckle in. Yeah. So the next day I go into work, and I didn't realize anything had happened at this point. I get a phone call at my job saying, hey, this is police officer da-da-da-da-da. I need you to come into the...
station,
department, yeah.
Yeah,
and I was like, they're like, well, there happened to be an incident last night, and we weren't able to locate you, so we need you to come in so we can have a discussion. And I'm sitting here like, this is very strange. And I was like, can you give me a little more information? Long story short, we agree. I said, I am at work. It's a 45-minute drive. I don't really want to drive there. I just drove from, you know, my house. I have to drive all the way back to Hershey, which was actually... I lived in Harrisburg at the time. That's a long story. But I was like, can we do this after work? They show up an hour later at my job, dressed in all SWAT, very tall police officers. And they're like, with my HR department, and they're like... we need to take you for a mental health evaluation. All right. So all my coworkers are sitting here looking around like, okay,
yeah.
This coworker has to have a mental evaluation. They had to send out 6 SWAT teams. But what happened was because my license was still originally in Hershey and it didn't update to Harrisburg. They had to get 2 police officers for every county they had to pass through. So
what? Okay.
So that's
all,
why
this is all work. This is all work.
This is all work. They show up and I'm like, well, I I get why, like, but I am reasonably sad. I said, I don't feel like I'm a threat to anybody or anyone else. And, you know, everybody's now like, ooh, what's going on? Thankfully, they weren't like the phone people. Here, let's film this.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's what you're right.
Oh, my. And, wow. And so everybody was pretty shocked. They're like, okay, well, we know that her engagement broke off. So, you know.
Okay, but they chalked up to that. Maybe something's going on there. Yeah,
yeah. So they were very supportive. I'm so thankful for my coworkers for not making me feel crazy. So thankfully, my one coworker actually knew my mother, and she had contacted my mother saying, hey, they gave her an ultimatum. They said she either can't come back to work until she gets this evaluation, or she goes with them, gets the evaluation, and once she passes, then she can come back to work. So they pretty much just kidnapped me. They took all my personal belongings. I couldn't make any phone calls. Like,
what?
Well, yeah. So, and
I don't want to cut you off. I'm sorry. I don't want to jump in. And this all kind of stemmed, just for myself and the listeners, from your friend.
A phone call
from the friend.
Right.
This is wild. Okay, continue.
It gets wild. Yeah. And so
they take all your belongings, all your personal, no cell phone, you can't contact anybody.
Right. And I want to, you know, because my foundation does support police officers, I want to make it very clear, like, they're doing what they need to do. When they get a call about somebody who is possibly a danger to them or other people, they have to gear up because they want to go back home to their family. So this is nothing on, but this is where we'll talk about the legislation a little bit later.
Okay.
So they take me to this facility, and it's the loony bin, right? They lock the doors, your padded rooms. They, I don't know how to do this very sensitively, but they do a full cavity check. Like, there is nothing you can hide.
Yeah, no weapons or anything hidden.
Yeah, drugs and, or anything. And also people who tend to kill or hurt themselves slice in private areas. So they have to make sure I didn't have any indicators that I might have been slicing or anything like that. So then you have to take a drug test, a pee test, a blood test. It's very invasive. And you have no choice. Like, you, once you're in there, you have to have this happen. And so we were, you know, I was talking with the doctor that was coming in for my evaluation. And, you know, they're asking all these questions that I felt, looking back, were very loaded. And I'm like, yes, I'm sad, but I'm reasonably sad. And they're like, well, did you take medication? I said, well, yeah, I took. And they're like, well, what'd you do? I said, well, I took Z-Quil. I woke up 6 hours later because I think it was supposed to be good for 8 hours. And so I took another dose. And they're like, well, that's overdosing. What? I'm like, you've got to be.
Z-Quil. Everybody. A lot of people take Z-Quil. It helps you go to sleep. That's what it's for.
If
you had a long day or you're a little stressed out. Yeah.
Right. And there was a lot on my mind. So I just, you know,
overdosing. Oh,
that was considered overdosing. Uh-huh. And then, of course, like, do you have any family history? And I was honest. And I was like, yeah. And I was like, unfortunately, every generation, for quite a few generations, I've had somebody who has unfortunately either attempted or is taking their life. So I was honest. And they're like, well, that's all we need. I was like, everything came back clear. They didn't find anything in the full cavity search. They didn't find anything in my blood, in my urine, no drug test. Everything came out clear. But because I said that I had a family history and I technically admitted to overdosing, even though it wasn't in my system at this point, they were like, well, you've got two choices.
Okay.
You either go in and we're going to hold you for, do a 72-hour hold, or you don't go in and we're going to make you a ward of the state. Well, I'm slightly sarcastic, and I was very not in the right set of mind to do this.
Yeah.
And I was like, listen, I am reasonably sad. I do not feel like me going to a facility for 72 hours, especially if this is how I'm going to be treated, is the real ideal place for me to go.
Right.
And I had told him, you know, we had talked about, you know, understanding depression and things like that. And I was like, yes, it runs in my family. We've had that conversation. I said, but I have coping mechanisms. So, needless to say, I became a ward of the state because I didn't want to say I needed help because I felt that I was reasonably sad.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, 72 hours, like being forced to do 72 hours. So it wasn't really a choice, but it was a choice.
I just, it blows my mind because you're just at work. What about your day to day? And then boom, it's like that. Like, I don't know if you heard the term, people have been swatted. Like, it's a thing with, I don't know. I don't know why. I've noticed very popular, like, YouTubers or these guys that have millions of subscribers and they're video game people. Literally, haters will call, like, local law enforcement and get them swatted. And people show up with full-on SWAT gear and stuff. So your friend, who was, I guess, worried about you because you didn't want to go out and hang out, called, and then, boom, just like that, and then you're ward of the state.
Yeah, yeah.
That escalated quickly.
Yeah, wow. And it gets weird. It gets weird. I don't know how far you want to go in the weirdness, but so the...
as you want to share?
I think it gives context to how reckless this can honestly be when there's not proper procedures.
Okay.
So there was a gentleman who was a very large man, probably like 6'5", 6'6", like he was a dude. And he walked in and it felt like, did you ever watch Green Mile?
Yes, I have. Yeah, yeah.
All right, so that's what it felt like. He had police officers around him. He had the old school shackles, like on both feet, tied up to his hands and his handcuffs.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm just like, what just walked in the room?
So you're in like
a holding
facility. I don't know, lack of a better term, but like a facility, holding facility. And how long are they going to keep you in there? If you're worried to stay, how does this work?
Well, they're waiting to get stuff transferred. So they have to go through my insurance and do all that process. So it's like going from a doctor's office to a hospital via ambulance. It takes a little time unless you're, you know, dying.
Yeah.
And because you're low on the totem pole for priority. So this guy goes in.
This giant walks in. That's a big dude. Yeah.
And you can tell, like, he's not all there. And so they put him in this room and they lock him up like they, because I can walk around at this point. It's just a little circle. I can pretty much see all the inmates like myself in the room. And then they lock him to the bed and like chain him up. And so they're doing all this stuff. They had to get him to change his scrubs. He comes out and he is just laughing like straight out of a horror film. And he's in his scrubs. Here, this man broke off of the table and cut his member, and he is just bleeding in his pants and just laughing hysterically. And I'm like, wow.
I don't belong here. You're probably thinking, what is going on?
Like, I feel like I'm like in a dream. Like, wake up. So I'm telling you about this man because I am now transferred at like 8 o'clock at night. Now, I got picked up around probably like 9 o'clock in the morning. And my parents actually showed up, and I'm 26 at the time, I believe, 26, 27. And I see them through the little window, and they're like, we want to talk to you. And they're like, you can't talk to her. Like, they won't even let me talk to my parents.
Why?
Right, I know.
They're your mom and dad.
They're like, my mom and dad.
If anything.
Right.
Why? Okay.
Right. I'm still not allowed a call yet. So. Okay. I end up getting transferred over, and because I'm a ward of the state, they pretty much told me, if you don't take all the medications, you try to fight them, you try to deny them, then we're going to hold you until you're what we call stable. So I go there, I get there, and they're like, oh, well, you have to take your medications. Now, I'm super sensitive to medications, with the exception of ZQL, because obviously that was like Kool-Aid. And...
But what medications? Like, these are just things that they think that you should be on.
Yeah, they're hardcore prescriptions. Like, it was Trazodone, I think, they gave
me. And it's stuff you haven't taken before, but it's just like, here,
no,
we think you have these issues, or you've shown maybe some signs.
Right. Unfortunately, like, part of my reason I'm hesitant for medications with that is because I had a family member who was on them, too, actually. One who ended up, because the chemical imbalance switched so quickly, they ended up killing themselves, overdosing on the medication. And then I had another one who tried to overdose, and they were able to save him. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so that was fun. And so they made me take it. And, of course, they do, like you see in the movies, move your tongue, make sure it's down. And then they send me to the room. Now, when you're in a facility like this, there's nothing locked. Like, no doors are locked. The beds are all, like, bolted down. Like, you might have, like, that inch, you know, prison type mattress.
Yeah.
All the seats and everything are play school. Like when I say play school, I mean like your little kid type of plastic seats. Mm-hmm. They're all bolted down. The mirrors are metal, so you can see the reflection. So this is pretty much a prison just for mental health. And the unfortunate thing is that this is also a co-ed place. So men and women are there.
Yeah.
So I have to, you know, I take my medications, I sleep, I wake up the next morning. There is another nice gentleman who actually hates women and likes to yell down the hallway of all the things that he likes to do to women and how much he wants to kill the women. And I'm like, oh, this is really nice. Moments later, that gentleman from the hospital shows up, the one that, you know.
Yeah, the giant.
Yes, the giant. And this time he has no police officers. He's got no handcuffs. He is just walking serious? Free.
They're just roaming.
Yes, just roaming. And I'm like, wow.
Men and women. Okay.
Men and women. This
is mind blowing. Yeah.
And so so I do my best to kind of mind my business.
Yeah.
And so fast forwarding, this giant ends up having a trigger that makes him go wild. I have a tone deafness, which is funny for singing, right? But I have a tone deafness, lower tones. It's very hard for me to hear the clarity of what they're saying. This giant mumbles. And when I say mumble, I mean like marbles.
Okay.
No actual articulation of words. And he starts talking to me and I'm like, crap. Like, I just knew it. And I looked at him and I smiled and I'm just like, ah, like, please. And well, I guess I wasn't responding properly. So he started chasing me. I run out of, because we were eating lunch. I'm running around. And now this is a circle facility. So there's no locked doors, no nothing. Thankfully, I watched the few bouncer size nurse men take him down. It took 3 tranquilizers and 4 men to go get this guy down.
Yeah.
And so later on, I have a meeting with the doctor and they're like, oh, we think that you have anxiety.
No kidding. No kidding. No shit. I'm sorry to say, no shit. Oh,
so, my gosh. So now,
oh, this is wild.
So,
okay.
So they're like, well, we're going to now double the dose
what?
Of what we're giving you, which I found super ironic because I tried ZQL, right? And
this is wild. Okay.
And Nicely. And then they have, they're like, and now we're going to give you Zoloft on top of that. So now I'm nominally doubled, but now I'm getting an additional thing. And I was like, I don't know. These medications are making me feel really off. And they're like, no, it's probably your anxiety. And I'm like, well, I don't know about you, but I don't really feel safe when there's one guy saying he wants to kill me and another one chasing me. And they're like, well, we have enough help coming in. And this is where my sarcasm gets me in trouble. And I'm like, you do realize that the difference between life and death is just a few seconds, right? I said, how long does it take for other nurses from other floors to come up here? And she's like, well, would you feel better if we moved you to the geriatric unit? I said, yes, yes, I would. I would feel great in the geriatric unit.
Wow. So how do you get out?
It just keeps going.
Don't leave us on a cliffhanger.
So so I go up to the geriatric unit, but this time the medication is like really getting to me, and I have a roommate. She's super sweet, but she's like an 80-year-old body with like a 5 or 6-year-old like mentality. She's super cute, but I go to bed early because I can't handle this. And she wakes me up, like she's like shoving me. She's like, I thought you died.
Oh, jeez. Okay.
She's like, I had to listen to you a couple times last night to make sure you were breathing. And I'm like, well, I don't really feel too good. She's like, oh, well, maybe we should go up and find somebody. So I tried to get up and I felt terrible. Long story short, walked down this long hallway to find a nurse, can't find one. Tell somebody else, a gentleman who also is not a geriatric but super kind, goes and finds the nurse. And she's like, oh, let's walk you the whole way back. And I said, no, I don't think I'm going to make it. Like, I feel like I'm dying.
Yeah.
And she's like, well, we have to take your blood pressure. And I'm like, can't you do that, like, here? So she walks me down the whole hallway. And next thing I know, she closes the door and I'm in an ambulance. That's what I remember. And so they're taking me back to the hospital. I'm getting, you know, cleaned up, pumped out, whatever. And then I end up getting transferred back.
No.
Yeah. So I was unresponsive for about 5 minutes. And so they, of course, overdosed me, ironically. And so then I come back and I'm thankfully at this point, my parents have contacted mayors, governors, and somebody made a call. I have no clue who. Thank you, whoever that was. But I have no clue who made it. So we get a meeting with them. And they're like, well, unfortunately, she's over 18, which means we can't release her to the parents because she's technically not under guardianship anymore. And so we have every authority, and this is the hospital talking, we have every authority to watch over her and take any measures needed to ensure her safety. Well, I get my sarcasm from my father, and so that probably didn't go well. But at the end of the meeting, mm-hmm. we ended up saying, listen, like, you made her, you killed her.
I'll say this is the same hospital, like overdosed you.
Yeah. And so there was an agreement, arrangement made where they're like, just get her out. So mm-hmm. they did that. Now, unfortunately, there was a lot of, what do we call that? When you take medication, a lot of like come down. I forget what that's called. It's there. The word's there. But so I had to clean out my system from all the medication. But what I found out later was that I actually got a red flag because I was a ward of the state. I no longer have any access to gun rights. Yeah. So.
Which is an American. We love our guns.
I know. And so I ended up talking to my parents and they're like, you need to go after them. Like, you need to get an attorney or something. And here's the thing that just floored me is that I talked to multiple attorneys and like I'm talking high level attorneys mm-hmm. and nobody would touch it because they said if I was underage, that would be one scenario. But because I am over the age of 18, it's very hard and the mental facilities have some form of immunity that includes taking care of you up and including death. So they take interventions based off of what they feel is best warranted for your situation. Now, what I found out later was that the one person, which thankfully this institution is no longer as of like a couple months ago, so I won't get her in trouble. But one of the nurses said, you would be surprised how often somebody who does not belong here gets put in here and they have to go through this process.
That's scary.
It was also stated that it depends on your insurance. And my parents sold insurance for a long time and they're like, you need to pay for the enhanced insurance. So guess what? I had like cream of the crop.
Yeah.
And I found out after that they were actually trying to petition, the hospital was trying to petition to the court to have me stay there indefinitely. Yeah. So... Wow.
It's like nightmares. Like, really, this is really what nightmares are made of, you know?
Yeah, it was. And, you know, by God's grace, I got out of there. Like, one way or the other, I got out. But, yeah, so that, I had so much trauma from that experience. Wow. And I didn't know what to do with it. And so I'm being told I have no legal repercussion. And... you know, nobody would cover the story or anything like that. And so I was like, well, my only outlet is Toastmasters. And so I did this story on, you know, like depression and just explaining what depression can look like, what depression can sound like, some of the interventions that they're using for depression and how they haven't really changed since like the 40s and 50s. They like add a little more of this, a little less of that, but there's no real intervention. And that was where Bruce and I really started to connect because I don't really remember how it happened. I think we had like a visitor or something and they were talking about like, would you be willing to do something like this, but based off of PTSD? And I'm like, I don't really know what PTSD is. Yeah. I mean, at that point I didn't. It wasn't really the word at that point. It was just kind of coming up. And I said, well, I don't know if I'm qualified to do it, but I'll be more than happy. And then I ended up, you know, talking to Bruce and getting some information and some of my other military friends about, you know, their experiences and what this looked like. And so I started to do speeches based off of that. And the stories were just wild. And talking about depression and kind of how PTSD links looks similar, I had so many veterans come up to me and they're like, your story, my hospital story.
Yeah.
Is a little different, but it's still my story. I went through what you went through. And I was floored at the fact that what happened to me, that wildness,
yes,
is commonplace. And I was like, no, maybe it's just the area. And that was where I found out the truth. It's more widespread than I could have ever imagined.
Wow. And for that to happen to our servicemen and women, you know, these are people that sacrificed their lives, livelihood, really, and everything for the country, which is, wow. So let's take a quick snack break because there's a lot going on. I feel like there's so much to unpack. This snack break is brought to you by Jerky Beef Jerky. When late night editing episodes for the podcast, Jerky Beef Jerky keeps me fueled and ready to go. With 11 grams of protein, high-quality ingredients, and no nitrates or nitrites. With 5 different flavors to choose from, Jerky Beef Jerky. Eat, meat, repeat.
So I don't know if I've ever heard that entire story from Shayna before, but I've heard parts of it. And when you first hear it, you think it's pretty uncommon. But as she noted, when she's mentioned it to other people, it's not that uncommon. And one of the issues, I've asked several veterans about this, and I've said, you know, there's a place for the mental health industry and what they do. Mm-hmm. But I've kind of mentioned that I'm working with Shane on this issue. And several of them said, oh yeah, that happened to me. I'm like, what happened to you? Well, I was talking to my counselor at the VA and I said something I didn't think was that far off. And all of a sudden they came in and they put me in a straitjacket and I couldn't get out of that institution until I did exactly what they said. I'm like, wow. Another one, I don't remember who he was talking to. He was talking to some sort of counselor and he said something. This is where I think the veteran part comes in. He said something that any veteran would have just laughed at.
Okay.
But the counselor took it to heart. And when he went home, a SWAT team showed up at his door, put him in cuffs, and they put him in an institution for 11 days or whatever it was. Jeez. And he was told, you can't get out of here until you say the right thing. So he was fine. He was just a little sarcastic.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, I can play the game. I'll say the right things. And he got out. But to a man, they said, I was much worse having gone through that incident. The one of them, and I don't know if this was you, but this is kind of common. One of them had a roommate who was crawling on the floor making animal noises, okay? And wow. That's supposed to help.
Yeah.
So yeah. Part of the issue
is,
we have this crisis line, and I'm sure there's people who are saved by it. But because of incidents like this, there is a reluctance to even call it. So what do we do if you're not even, well, what she said, a veteran doesn't want to lose their rights to their guns. That's right. Part of their life. That's just part of who they are. And they know that if they call that line and they get labeled, that's it for their gun rights. And they won't be able to hunt. They won't be able to do the things that they love.
They love, yeah.
So there's a reluctance to even engage that system. And one of the things that came out in not even being prompted was, I really wish I could have just sat around the fire with a bunch of veterans and talked to them, because they would have gotten what I was saying without it spiraling into this thing where they got put in an institution unwillingly. Mm-hmm. And if only I had had that, but they were separated from their people, their tribe.
Yeah.
And so that's where, you know, Shane and I have started talking about establishing a place where this can happen. And there are prototypes for this, but there's nothing really around here. And some of them only cater to combat wounded veterans. Some of them are very specific in who they cater to. But the issue is not just combat veterans, and it's not just wounded veterans. Mm-hmm. It's about 60-40, 60% of the 22 a day never saw combat. I'm pretty sure that is about right.
Yeah.
So that's not the only issue that's going on. So we're trying to make an open tent for the people who are, and then the other part of this is that we've talked about is that first responders often go through the same thing. Yeah. And whether it's the police or firefighters or EMS, they're seeing things that the public doesn't see. They are kind of isolated from and need to kind of have their crew around. So that's where we've started talking about what can we do before a person gets to that point. Can we help them with just being around other people? That would cut that spiral off before the substance abuse, before they lose their job, before they lose their family, and, you know, go upstream. There's a story, I think it's from Africa, where there's people in a village and they see these babies floating down the stream and they run in to get them, and then more and more come, and finally someone says, we got to go upriver and find out why this is happening. And so that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to go upstream of the issue. There are a lot of really good work being done at the mental health level once they're in the spiral. But what can we do before that? Let's try to engage these veterans early on after they get out, before they founder and realize that they're out of place, and bring them back together.
And I think some of them do realize that they're out of place, because kind of going back to what you said was when we were doing the interview. So before the foundation actually got started, I was actually asked to, I filled out a competition for Penn State. And one of the things is that you had to have certain amount of hours of interviews. And one of the things that I noticed in all of these interviews was that they were saying, I just wanted someone to talk to, you know, I just wanted someone to talk to. And
get
so
off
they,
their chest, right?
They called the crisis line, you know, like I had to do things when I was over there that, you know, I have a child and it impacted a child, or I don't think my wife would understand. You know, most of them were men that I ended up talking to. So I don't want to sound like I'm, but it was that they just wanted someone that they could talk to that wouldn't change their life. And, you know, and we had talked previously about having the opportunity to work with Doug Mastriano, and I had put out a request like, hey, can I get some quick testimonies? And you'd be surprised how many of them write in saying like, hey, this is why. And I just asked simple questions like, would you, based off your experience, would you ever do it again? And they said, absolutely not. And you know, we talk about the 22 a day, and as Bruce had mentioned, it's, you know, there's stuff for if you're okay, there's stuff if you're not okay, but where is that in the middle when you start to notice, like, I just want to talk to somebody, and you're talking to somebody then spirals you, and kind of touching on what Bruce said is that, you know, I had talked to a friend recently who had gone through the VA. They just, you know, they were going through the texting thing, and they said, listen, you know, I'm kind of having some hard time here. And they're like, oh, come in for come in so we can talk to you and maybe get you something to ease you out. And they got the same choice I did. You either choose to come in or you choose to stay. And then they're bunked with people that make their situation worse. And then they got to the point that they even said to me, I felt that if I didn't try to act normal at this point, they were going to try and keep me there indefinitely. So the fact that they had that feeling, and they were actually one of my friends that was very like pro, like VA crisis. So then after this experience, they're like, I'm going to hesitate if I ever consider reaching out to them again. So it was like, even people who are calling in, like my case was somebody who was calling, and the scariness of the stranger, right? Like any stranger could call and say, oh, I just saw this person do this.
Yeah.
And then they can come and get you, like you said, with the swatting.
That's really, yeah.
But the fact that people are calling in on their own, they're recognizing, hey, I need help. Mm-hmm. I just want someone to talk to. And then with some of those conversations, testimonies that came back that I gave to the senator were like, I had my whole, I called at, 2 o'clock in the morning, because that's usually when the thoughts happen. And they showed up at my door. They busted in the house. They woke up my wife and my child. And right. I ended up losing my job because they kept me for 6 weeks. Another one was they barricaded the whole street, came in with spotlights. And I'm assuming, I don't know exactly, but I'm assuming because mm-hmm. they were active duty or a recent deployment, that they're like, you need to come out with your hands up. Well, they have their children now sitting inside, looking out, watching their dad come up, spotlight, like they're a criminal. And all they did was call and say, hey, like, I'm kind of struggling. I'm not able to sleep.
I just want to talk to somebody. You're making the situation worse.
Right.
Because that person's already, so they took the step to acknowledge, right? I need help, right? I need help. So they reach out to the VA or whomever, whatever the hotline is, thinking, okay, they'll get help. Someone to talk to, just get it off their chest.
Right.
And maybe it's because the people they're talking to, and I don't know if this is true in all scenarios, but the people they're talking to are just civilians. So when they hear some of these terms or this person that's in the service or active or a veteran sharing whatever it may be, as a civilian, they're panicking, or these are red flags. Right. And then all of a sudden, like we've been saying, they're showing up full SWAT gear, guns drawn, bright lights. Now it's okay, my wife and kids are at home. What's going on? So they could, if it was me, I'd probably come out, I'd want to have a firearm on me, because what's going on? You don't know. It's not making the situation any better.
Right.
So it's almost like, it sounds like what you all are trying to do at Interceding Foundation is prevent that from even happening. Like, let's have a conversation with like-minded people that have been through what, that service man or woman has gone through.
Right. And taking it from the first responder perspective, they have to execute these. So why would they call? If they see what happens, would they call?
Yeah.
And I can't tell you how many of them, they're like, no, I won't. They're like, they'll lose their job too. And that was one of the reasons that, I don't know if we actually covered that yet, was that the calling, like losing their rights. But I've had them where they called in for help while they're active duty, they lose their ranking, they lose their benefits, and they get dishonorably discharged.
Now, everything's gone.
You
worked hard for it. Everything's gone.
Yeah.
Because you called because you needed help.
Right. And I've also heard police officers that have done the same thing where they didn't call in for help, but they had a traumatic incident, and they were told that the part of the paperwork, right, is they have to go to the counselor. And they might have said something or slightly hinted to, like, yeah, that kind of impacted me. And then next thing we know, they're working at the desk. And they're like, I didn't want to work at the desk because I feel like I'm fit. I just needed someone to talk to or, processing through that. And so we talked about veterans. I do want to just give a little bit of a, background for what I learned from police officers that I don't know if a lot of people actually realize. And I know this kind of happens. I'll touch on dispatch too real quick. But when I interviewed the police officers, there was one in particular that worked in an inner city. So it's high crime. They're already short. This was around the time where they're like, defund the police. So it got really heated. So they said that there was one day that they had to work, like it was like a 16, 18 hour shift. They went from a homicide, an attempted suicide, and a domestic violence,
that weighs heavy.
Which are all like the domestic violence from most of the police officers I talk to are the ones that they absolutely do not want to go to because they are the highest risk.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times it's domestic dispute. And then when the cop shows up, then all of a sudden the two that are fighting are now fighting the police officer,
Right.
But a normal person does not have to experience that all in one day.
Yeah.
That's
what I mean. That's very heavy stuff. And that's traumatic for one individual to go through. Right. And then they want to go home to their their family, but you can't talk. I mean, sure, you can talk to your wife about it, but you don't want to do that because you don't want to put that on her shoulders, you know?
And anyway, a lot of times you can't talk to them because if there's an investigation that comes up, too. They can subpoena the spouse. So that's another point of isolation. And a lot of times they can't even talk to like peers, depending on what type of investigation it is. So it's very hard that like we talk about isolation, and that's one of the, you know, hardest. And I want to talk about dispatch. They're hard too. I don't know if anybody's ever like really thought about the helpless situation when there's a trauma, dramatic situation going. And it's not like the movies where, you know, like the hero's going to come in and get the day. A lot of times they might be there when that person dies. You know, they're on the phone and it's heavy. It's super heavy. And I had somebody that was training. They were new to the dispatch, and it was a very short-lived career. But they were on there, and there was a person who called in, and they were giving indicators that they were being trapped, almost like somebody was trying to kill them or something. The phone cut off. First instinct, call the number back.
Right, right.
And it's like, well, what if they have the ringer on? You just gave their location. They were not able to get them. They dispatched people. They were never able to find that person. And then they're like, I can't do this, you know? And they're like, well, you were training, and that was like a, you know, a natural thing. And unfortunately, these things do happen. But it was like, nope, I'm done.
Yeah.
I'm done.
Oh,
and,
for sure.
You know, and we don't think about that on this side. We're just like, just take the call.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, you don't think about it, what people go through. You right. just. And that defund the police was wild, you know, because it's like they're your first line of defense. Who are you going to call, you know, when you need help or something's going on? It's just that whole thing was wild in my mind. But you don't think about the dispatch or the ambulance, you know, the first responders that show up, no matter what, you know, they are. It's like those people see things and go through stuff just like everybody else, but they might not be able to talk about it, and it weighs heavy.
Yeah. And I want to throw one more out there
before
we move on, just so we can get a full. So I want to talk about the nurses and the doctors, right? So there is a lot of abuse that happens to nurses and doctors from actual patients. And the unfortunate thing is the way that it's set up is that they are guaranteed care, right? Like if somebody comes into a hospital with an emergency, they're guaranteed care. You can't just not give them care. There have been nurses that have told me that they've been physically abused. They've been emotionally, mentally abused. And they're just told, like, hey, you need to deal with them until they're discharged. Like, while you're on duty, you have to be discharged. Some of them might try and switch with somebody, and that might work. But a lot of times there's not that option because they're already short-staffed. They're already working long hours. They already have a lot of people that they have to watch, and for somebody to walk from a completely other end to deal with a complicated person. Mm-hmm. So like, just really imagine like you're trying to take care of this person and they're physically coming after you, and you have no repercussion because if you touch them in the wrong way, you're in HR.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it's like, what are you supposed to do? Right. Yeah. And there's no real protections out there. So I just went, as we're talking about this, of how like this foundation is being built and developed, it's off of all of this knowledge, all of these shared testimonies. And because what we want is that a lot of, let me make sure I word this right. A lot of resources that we do find are like, hey, this is the resource we have. This is what we're giving to you. But what we want is, hey, let us get to know you, figure out what your needs are, and let us find the resources that provide what you need.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But that's not an approach that a lot of nonprofits take. And that's kind of, I don't want to say nonprofit specifically, but resources take. It's like you go to the VA, and it's mostly medication, you know, counseling, medication. There might be some odds and ends stuff. But in reality, they might just need a person to help them out with some finances, or they might just need somebody to help them out with a relationship. And, you know, but it's like the medication's not going to help either of that. So really just want the audience to know, like, when we're building this foundation, it's built from people who have shared their deepest, darkest stories.
Yeah.
and what they're really needing. And, you know, as Bruce said, we're going up that river. And what we're finding is that we need to help when it's just a little problem before it becomes
a gigantic problem. Yeah.
Because the medication, like when you're at that bottom of the spiral, nothing short of a miracle or a physical intervention is going to prevent the inevitable at the bottom of the spiral. So, and that's what we're really trying to focus on addressing.
Yeah. I just want to real quick, you know, Shane, I want to thank you for sharing your story and being so open. And Bruce, I want to thank you for your service, just so we get that before we get to the end of the episode. And
stay tuned next week, Wednesday morning, for part 3.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a review. To see photos of today's guests and more content, just search American Grown Podcast on Facebook and Instagram.
If you'd like to be a featured guest on the podcast, please direct message or email Austin at AmericanGrownPod@gmail.com.
This episode was brought to you by these sponsors.
Modern Gent Customs is your go-to for all your custom apparel and headwear needs. From individuals to businesses, with no minimums or design fees ever, inquire today at info@moderngentcustoms.com.
Cleona Coffee Roasters is a small batch coffee roastery and coffee shop. Veteran and first responder owned, community oriented, and roasted fresh to order. Now open inside 911 Rapid Response, Anvil, PA. Go to CleonaCoffeeRoasters.com to order online, see updated hours, and find where you can buy it close to you.
Hostler Engraving is your local source for unique, quality-driven laser-engraved gifts for all occasions. Place an order today by visiting our Facebook page at Hostler Engraving. You won't be disappointed.
Are you in the mood for some mouth-watering Italian dinners? Homemade bread, cheese steaks, hot subs, cold subs, salads, sides, and of course, delicious pizza? Look no further than Angelo's, located at 1032 South 5th Ave, Lebanon. Call 717-273-8579 to place your order now. Triggered 22 LLC, a veteran-owned apparel company. By purchasing a t-shirt, hat, or hoodie from Triggered 22, you're not only supporting a small business, but you're bringing awareness to veteran PTSD and suicide. Please help save the lives of those who fought for our freedoms. Visit triggered22.com now and place your order. Let's help those suffering from invisible wounds.